Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this half hour, we're going to continue with the discussion with Chris Simpson, the author of The Science of Coercion, Communication Research in Psychological Warfare, 1945 to 1980, hard and soft cover editions by the Oxford University Press, copyright 1994. Chris, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
We're talking about the overlap and the interrelationship between communication research and psychological warfare, and that relationship is in many ways concretized in the form of a number of, in fact, you identify six different centers of communication research that grew up in the 1950s, the Bureau of Applied Social Research, the Institute for Social Research at the University of Michigan, the National Opinion Research Center, the Bureau of Social Science Research, the RAND Corporation, and one that I'd like to leave for a few minutes into this discussion, the Center for International Studies. You talk about those institutions and their dual roles as both national security entities and academic entities, and in turn, I realize this is a tall order, but their relationship with Public Opinion Quarterly, which in many ways served as a mouthpiece for the dissemination of the work that they generated.
Well, I think you've summarized it pretty well, and it would be redundant for me to go back over it. Now the book concentrates on the period between 1945 and 1960. One thing that I think is worth examining is the extent to which the academy and places like Bureau of Applied Social Research are very liberal institutions. They're politically liberal. I have no doubt that most of the people voted for the Democrats, and some of them considered themselves left Democrats, or even one form or another of Marxist, one description or another. Anyway, the point being is that scientists and intellectuals, for the most part, or certainly to a greater degree than the society as a whole, are left of center. I don't think that's any particular secret. And maybe in economics the story is different, but certainly in the social sciences that's the case. Well, so if that is so, what explains then, first of all, this work on national security programs, and second of all, and more fundamentally, this sort of cultural, this participation in a cultural transformation that built a national security state that most of us take for granted as being just the way the world is. And I think that part of the answer to that is that what happened was that the scientists tended to internalize the values of the national security state as a means of marketing themselves to the national security state. Now, these are not dumb people. They're not naive. At the same time, they rather often tended... Let me back up for just a minute and explain something that was going on in the early 1950s.
If I could interject ever so briefly, Chris, I think that the National Science Foundation study in 1952 showing that 96% of all social science funding came from the military at that time would certainly both explain and perpetuate what you just talked about. Go ahead.
Right. Well, in the early 1950s, you had an attack from the McCarthyite right wing on the social sciences and on even on the Voice of America. Those of your listeners who are familiar with McCarthy know that the Voice of America was held up as being a hotbed of subversion. Right. So this attack extended to the big foundations, such as the Ford Foundation and the Carnegie Foundation. Rockefeller Brothers Fund was held. Rockefeller Brothers was held up as being a secret front for socialism and one world government, and so on. Now, you know, I'll grant you that the Rockefellers have played a complex political role in the United States and around the world, but to see Nelson Rockefeller as a closet socialist, I think is a little bit silly. But anyway, so there was this attack from the extreme right, and the way that these academics and their foundations, like the Ford Foundation and so on, and the big universities, the big Ivy League schools, the way they defended themselves in hearings before Congress was to say, well, what we're doing with sociology the most potent tool for fighting back the communist menace, we as intellectuals are forging a whole new science in how to fight the bad guys and how to advance American interests, and American interests in kind of the 1984 think of the time, I mean the double think of the time, automatically meant all those good things about America that we would like to believe, and you know, about democracy, liberty, equality of opportunity, you know, all that good stuff. So the way that the liberal academics protected themselves against the radical right was to sort of circle the wagons, so to speak, to use a metaphor, and close down in on a center of the profession, on a small group of narrow ideas that were acceptable to the national security state, and those became the central ideas that were permissible to be taught in American universities about this particular subject, that were permissible to be written about in academic journals about this particular subject. And in turn, that particular form of ideological conformity, of a liberal aroma, if you will, became really the only articulation of what communication or what communication research is or should be that was permitted in this country. Both the left and the right were, to a very large degree, crushed. And if you want to talk about the left wing, you had the FBI. I mean, in New York City, there was a school for social research that was basically run by the left, and it drew something like 5,000 students a year. The FBI said, "Oh, well, this is a communist plot," and indeed, there were, in fact, Communist Party people involved in that school. You know, Communist Party people read books like anybody else, and so the FBI subpoenaed their student lists and canceled their tax exemption and basically harassed the institution out of existence. So that if you had the wrong ideas about what permissible sociology was, you faced genuine persecution. I was reading some declassified records. The early academic sociological society had the unfortunate acronym of American Sociological Society. If you think that through, you'll see what I'm saying. I got a bunch of Army intelligence records where Army intelligence, for heaven's sakes, was sending secret agents into the meeting of the American Sociological Society in an effort to smoke out radicals, and they would sit in the sessions and furiously take notes to figure out whether or not Professor so-and-so had said something that was out of line.
There are a lot of people who confuse sociology with socialism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they're entirely different concepts.
Of course,
is a so-called behavioral science that looks at how groups of human beings behave.
Right.
Now, I would argue that a lot of sociology has preconceptions built into it.
Sure.
That tend to reinforce the power relations that already exist. Socialism Well, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. I mean, that's one of those words that one can talk about its definition for the next, 6 or 8 hours and not be any clearer about it than when you began.
I was simply noting that many people do make that error. They confuse two totally different things. Some of the names that loom large in your discussion of the interrelationship between mass communication and psychological warfare from 1945 to 1960... Wilbur Schramm and a major text that he wrote, which in many ways helped to shape mass communication research.
Wilbur Schramm was he ended up as dean of the School of Communication at Stanford. He was very much the author of he wrote a book about propaganda in the mid 1950s, in which he put forward the idea that there were these several different forms of communication. And two of them that are relevant here are authoritarian and totalitarian. And if you remember the Reagan years, you will remember that the argument made by people like Gene Kirkpatrick and so on were mass murderers, literally mass murderers, like Pinochet in Chile, for example, or Marcos in the Philippines, or you know the list.
Mm-hmm.
That they were authoritarians, which was bad, but not all that bad. Whereas Brezhnev era USSR or Czechoslovakia, in 1967, these were supposedly totalitarian societies that were somehow qualitatively more brutal and vicious than Pinochet's Chile, and that this therefore justified the extreme measures of building, 20,000 nuclear weapons in an arms race against these people.
That book, by the way, The Process and Effects of Mass Communication.
The Schramm exactly text. Right. So anyway, this distinction between authoritarian and totalitarian, at least in my opinion, is largely contrived and is largely a political distinction. And it has little scientific merit. It's because what it does is it just lumps very different types of societies together and pretends that they're all one.
At the risk of seeming a trifle corny, it actually seems to me like an actual realization of Orwell's Newspeak.
Well, to a certain extent, I think that you're right. I mean, you had everything from Kim Il Sung's style North Korea to the Italian Communist Party presented as a single monolithic block, and then on the other hand, you had genuinely genocidal government, such as that which emerged in Guatemala, for example, to name only one example, that were somehow America's friends. So these ideas, they get off campus and they become the code speak that politicians use, that journalists use, that professors use, that the people on the chat shows on Sunday morning use, and so on, to justify whatever policy happens to be in vogue at a given time.
On page 85, you write, "This continuity of leading theoreticians became part of a broader pattern through which the psychological warfare of one generation became the international communication of the next." If I'm understanding you correctly, I think that sort of exemplifies and sums up what you were just talking about.
Yeah. What happened? I'll give you a good example, and in some ways it's kind of amusing, is that there was a particular researcher named Chitra Smith who did an annotated bibliography called, in the early 1950s, called Propaganda and Psychological Warfare, in which she systematically collected everything that had been published on this and made little descriptions of it and where it could be found and so forth and so on. All right. That was originally done under a secret contract. By the mid-1950s, the rhetoric was starting to change, and the whole way that the newspeak was put was starting to change for reasons that are explained in the book. And Chitra Smith's bibliography which had begun as propaganda and psychological warfare, was printed by, I believe it was Columbia University Press, but you'll have to check me on that, but was published by a leading academic press under the title of International Communication. The identical text, the identical discussion of what communication was and where the articles were to be found and what it consisted of and how it worked and who was right and who was wrong and all of the rest, went from being a classified text on propaganda and psychological warfare to being a public text called International Communication. And this is one example of how the doublespeak about communication and indeed about sociology, about how we look at society, how that grows and how it sort of mutates decade after decade. I think today that we're in, you know, we're in a new stage. I mean, we're not in the 1950s anymore, but the same mutation process continues.
Chris, we're running low on time there. I'd like to hit a few more points briefly, illustrating that evolution from yesterday's psychological warfare to today's or tomorrow's communication theory. Daniel Lerner, in his book, The Passing of Traditional Society.
Right. Originally done for The Voice of America and becomes the foundation of what is called, euphemistically, in my opinion, the development school of communication research. Development is the early version of the International Monetary Fund business that's going on right now in terms of the economic penetration of Asian societies and Mexico and so on. What Lerner argued in a nutshell is that people were starting to learn about the world, but they didn't in societies such as Egypt, for example, to name only one example. But they didn't have any political power, which was true enough, and that made them angry. So Lerner's solution was to come along with a variety of propaganda techniques to try to sort of ease them into feeling comfortable with their powerlessness. And when that didn't work, the next step, which was developed largely at MIT...
At the Center for International Studies, which was one of those six organizations which overlap academia and national security that we alluded
exactly.
to earlier. Go ahead.
Exactly. So the next step was to add policemen and guns and different types of... first of all, selective violence, you know, I mean, targeting trade union leaders, for example, for either co-optation on the one hand or to be murdered on the other hand. And then when the selective violence didn't always do the job, you had the emergence of what is today called low-intensity warfare. And low-intensity warfare really is full-scale warfare carried out at the grassroots. You have armies fighting against the civilians of their own countries. So this interweaving of the rationale or the claims about how communication work very rapidly spill over into military doctrine. It's because military doctrine, if you have a society that cannot hold itself together because it is so unjust, then the first thing they try is propaganda to convince people to put up with it despite its injustice. And then when the propaganda fails, the next thing that happens are death squads and various forms of war against civilians. And that particular evolution, we've seen it It started in Greece in the 1940s and up through the 1950s, and it continues to be used today.
You mentioned that development theory actually holds that unchecked or unregulated development in the Third World would actually be deleterious to U.S. national security. And on page 90, you write, "Thus, the CINES approach, that's the Center for International Studies, came to be called development theory," unquote, by communication specialists. Among military planners, it took the name limited warfare, unquote,
right,
or perhaps low-intensity warfare, a term that became very well known on the U.S. national security stage in the 1980s.
Sure. Limited warfare is a linguistic predecessor to low-intensity warfare. I mean, limited warfare served its purpose in providing a rationale for the American invasion of Vietnam, and then sort of burned itself out on that, and so they came up with a new term. The new term is low-intensity warfare.
Among the types of development that was seen as possibly injurious to the U.S., you mentioned, was the desegregation of schools in Little Rock.
Right. Well, Little Rock was studied in these same terms. The unifying theme here is not that the U.S. government is against any sort of development, because that's not the case.
Sure.
What it is that the U.S. government only wants development that is cooperative to and subordinate to the U.S. demands on a given country, which typically come in the form of either labor or natural resources. Sometimes it comes in the forms of places to put naval bases or Air Force bases. So development is well and good as long as it's done on the Americans' terms. That's why, for example, the implication of that, let me say it this way, the implication of that theory is what happened in Nicaragua during the Reagan administration. Here you have a tiny country that's about the size of Virginia and that has a smaller population than the state of Virginia, which, heaven forbid, was providing a good example to the rest of Central America. It improved its education. It lowered the infant mortality rate, better health, better food, and contrary to what the Reagan administration said, was actually rather free intellectually in terms of what was broadcast on the radio, and certainly freer than Guatemala was or El Salvador in terms of what was broadcast on the radio or published in the newspapers and so forth. But it was a bad example from Washington's point of view, and that's why they were willing to spend tens of millions of dollars in many people's lives and cook up these Oliver North schemes, you know, in order to destroy Nicaragua economically. They tried to do the same thing with Cuba. I'm not a big fan of Cuba, you know. I'm not trying to apologize for bad things that happened in other countries. But what I'm trying to say is that if the Americans see development, even successful development, that is not under their thumb, then they'll try to destroy it. And this has been such a consistent pattern for almost 50 years now that I think that as Americans, as voters, as taxpayers, we have to take a look at this and understand exactly how destructive this is to people around the world.
Chris, I'd like to take just a minute to talk about Public Opinion Quarterly and its manifestation of the overlap between covert action and academic theory, and that by way of a jump point to your newest title, which also covers the relationship between national security affairs and academia. Public Opinion Quarterly and its national security-connected editor, DeWitt Poole.
Yeah, DeWitt Poole was a propaganda specialist at the State Department and was one of a really very small coterie of people. I mean, we're talking about a couple dozen people who articulated American policy towards the Soviet Union going back to like 1917. I mean, we're talking about several generations back now. DeWitt Poole went on sabbatical from the State Department, where he was basically a professional anti-Bolshevik policy strong-arm guy. I mean, you see the same types today in Washington, or I do. And he went to Princeton, where he set up Public Opinion Quarterly, and its function was to encourage the study and the exploitation of that study of public opinion in the interests of powerful people in the United States, both corporate and government interests. That's who DeWitt Poole was.
He had backgrounds in OSS and CIA, too, didn't
sure,
he?
Sure, and the old radio liberation from Bolshevism and so on. Some of these emigre operations that employed ex-Nazis. You read the headlines recently about marches of former SS men in Lithuania and the bombing of a synagogue in Latvia. And,
sure.
And so on, and you see that these people are still with us. Anyway, to plug the new title, it's called Universities in the Empire. It's a collection of essays, and the essays I introduced it, but the essays are not by me, they're by other people, and they're quite good. And there's one essay about Project Camelot, for example, and there's a second one that looks at the history of international studies. There's an essay that looks at Russians in the Soviet Union, studies of the history of science, and then how those changed as perestroika and glasnost came along, and how it would take a little bit of time to explain the whole argument, but the gist of it was that there's considerably more similarity in the intellectual life in the Soviet Union and the United States than either side has been willing to admit. Now, that's not to say they had the same ideas.
Sure.
But I'm talking about the dynamics of how power is spread out in those societies, particularly in intellectual circles.
Would you say it would be accurate to characterize that title to a certain extent as discussing how what you talk about as the dominant paradigm in communication research to a certain extent has been set by this relationship between academia and national security?
I think so. Yeah, I think that's a good way to sum it up, sure.
All righty, that title again, Chris?
It's called Universities in the Empire. It's just out. It's by the New Press, and it should be available, via the World Wide Web. There's a variety of, and of course local bookstores. There's a variety of ways to obtain it.
Universities in the Empire, edited by Chris Simpson, the New Press, copyright 1998, correct?
Right, exactly.
Alrighty, a new title, once again illustrating the relationship between academia and national security, not only in the U.S., but elsewhere as well. We've been visiting with Chris Simpson, the author of, among other titles, The Science of Coercion, Mass Communication Research and Psychological Warfare, 1945 to 1960. That is published in hardcover and softcover by the Oxford University Press, and copyright 1994. For Chris Simpson, this is Dave Emery, saying thanks for listening.